Albert listened to the world around him. The unnerving sound of a nearby woodpecker made him cautious. He gripped his Springfield rifle a little tighter and raised his left hand in a fist. Behind him, four fellow Yankees dropped down beneath the undergrowth, awaiting Albert's next move. Ahead of him was the edge of the forest, and beyond, the pulverized ruins of the outskirts of the city of Vicksburg, Mississippi, still smoldering from the most recent bombardment. The sun has begun to set, and Albert knows he must press on if he's going to be able to report back anything of use to Captain Bush. He beckons his close friend Charles Ives to join him. It feels too quiet, and the gathering storm clouds prophesize an outbreak of a storm ahead. Albert and Ives silently slip out of the undergrowth and dash towards the nearest building, which was little more than a few bricks and masonry. Feeling secure enough, they cover the stretch from the forest to the wall as the rest of their comrades sprint over the short distance. Albert steels himself and swings his rifle around the corner, and then all hell breaks loose. Not the storm breaking, but the sound of bullets flying and men's grunts as the entire patrol is ambushed by men in grey uniforms. Albert finds himself alone fighting off two young boys, not long out of childhood, but they have the upper hand, and Albert looks on in despair as his unit retreats away from the fight, leaving him behind. One of the boys is eyeing him curiously, and it takes all of Albert's nerve to stay calm. They have him now, but they are unaware that he is hiding a great secret, one which, if they were to discover, would make Albert's life a living hell. He simply had to escape, and as the boys began ransacking his fallen comrades' bodies, Albert saw his chance and tore off into the gathering darkness. His secret was safe, for now. Hello guys, and welcome back to the Cloak and Dagger podcast, a podcast where we tell enticing tales from across history. I am your host, Will Davis Coleman, and I'm joined as ever by Patrick Courtney, who is looking very confused after that walkthrough.
Yeah, to be fair, part of that is also, I really like enticing tales.
Right?
That worked really well. Because it's not, does it count as alliteration because the T is in the middle of the word?
I'm going to say it is, yeah. I'm going to give myself a little wave for that.
Enticing tales. Maybe enticing. We should just stick with that one.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. After all that, yeah, how many have we done now?
Well, we've been kind of changing it every time, but maybe we've just been looking for the right one.
Maybe we've just
enticing tales is pretty good.
Yeah, maybe. So yeah, welcome back to the podcast, guys. If you're a first-time listener, welcome. And if you enjoy what you hear today, please go back. We have we're up to 60 episodes now over the last sort of 4 years.
Are we?
Yeah, we're definitely over 50.
I guess we've got bonus episodes as well.
Yeah.
Which I think pushes over, definitely.
Yeah, so go back and listen to some of those.
Whole backlog of historical tales from... I feel like have we hit all continents?
Not Antarctica.
Oh, that doesn't count.
We could ask.
We
Oceania? Oceania, sorry. I don't think we have. Have we not done one in Australia?
Yes, I've got ones to do in Australia, and I think we need to do one.
Okay.
Deeply apologise to all our Australian listeners that we will get to you.
This year, 2025, is going to be your year.
Yeah, sure.
In terms of our podcast,
yeah. Could be a good year anyway, but yeah.
We wish you, that whole continent, a really good year. We hope it goes well.
If you would like to find out even more information about the podcast, we have an Instagram at Cloak and Dagger Podcast, where we put up extra images or just images for the episodes that are coming out. We have a sneak peek and we have a little extra fact. And then also some other posts that come out, kind of highlight what we're up to. It's a good way to get more information because a lot of this stuff, you want to see literally the last episode, there's a phenomenal painting that went along with it. So listen to the last episode, but didn't check out our Instagram. Go and check it out because there is... I can't remember who did it, but it's a while ago that the painting was made, but it's a phenomenal painting that encapsulates that episode. And I won't reveal what it is because you have to go back and listen to it, but it's a phenomenal painting.
I think it was painted about 1,000 years afterwards by a Frenchman.
Yes, yeah. I think maybe like 600 years.
No, I think it's from the 1800s.
I'm thinking, I'm getting my dates wrong the other way. Yes, you're right. So it is about 1,000 years
after. It's a great painting. Seriously good.
Phenomenal.
Yeah. Anyway, go and check that out. And yeah, you guys know the thing. Go tell your friends and family.
Yeah.
Get that word spread and give us a 5-star rating if you fancy it or whatever.
Yeah.
And yeah, but let's get into it, shall we?
Let's get started.
Okay. Okay, so to start off our story today, you might have heard in the sneak peek, Patrick, that I said Mississippi.
You did say Mississippi.
Do you have any sort of thing? What do you glean from the sneak peek? Any sort of clues about today's story?
Civil War.
Which?
Which?
Be specific.
The American Civil War.
Aha.
I got that from the term Yankee.
Yeah.
I assume, well, presumably existed before the Civil War, but
yeah, it was mainly.
And also, there's soldiers, which also gave it away.
True.
I assumed it wasn't the War of Independence.
Yeah, no.
What is it, Lancashire Rifle? Did you
Springfield.
Say? Springfield Rifle.
Yeah.
Don't think they had that during the War of Independence.
Definitely
so.
Not. Not that kind of reloader.
Mm.
There's no way. So yeah, okay. And also I said Vicksburg, Mississippi, which obviously places it mm-hmm. quite firmly in the US. But actually, I'm going to start today's tale far, far away from the US.
Okay.
Right over, not far from where we're sat, actually.
Oh.
Well, comparatively, compared to Mississippi.
In this country of ours.
Exactly. In the North Atlantic Archipelago. In Ireland.
The North Atlantic Archipelago.
That's what it's called.
Is that really what it's called?
Yeah.
That's so pretentious.
I did. It was in my course at uni, doing history. And I
hate that.
They called it the North Atlantic Archipelago.
And it's just the British Isles. It doesn't include...
No, I think it also includes Iceland and, like, not Svalbard, but, like, the Faroe Islands, Orkney Islands.
Yeah. Greenland? No, that
wasn't. That's too far.
Too big.
That's Eric the Red's territory.
We're not in an archipelago though, with Iceland. It's miles away.
Yeah.
That's just...
Well, maybe the other ones. Maybe it was Faroe Islands.
Faroe Islands, I give you. But also, Hebrides. Just calling ourselves an archipelago, like, that's tropical. Has to be.
Okay.
In my mind, it has to be tropical.
Okay, well, anyway,
mm-hmm.
our story today actually starts in County Louth,
okay.
in Ireland.
Where's Louth?
So, County Louth is one of the border counties
okay.
with Northern Ireland and Southern Ireland. If you go to Dublin and went literally straight north up the coast before you obviously hit the border, it's all up there. So Drogheda, I think, is just inside Louth.
Right.
And Dundalk is also in Louth.
Okay, yeah.
But our story today, there was no border then.
Yeah.
No, there wasn't. I was like, oh.
And isn't there like a vague, like, kind of British liking? I mean, you have the counties and you know.
Yeah.
So there's something there.
Oh, it was British ruled Ireland,
yeah.
for sure. Because where I'm taking you to is the Christmas Day of 1843.
Okay.
And in that time, in a little town on the Irish Sea coast, so you're on the east of Ireland,
mm-hmm.
on that coastline, to a little town called Cloughead.
Cloughead.
Mm. And Cloughead is where a little baby was being baptised on Christmas Day.
Ah, lovely. Yeah. What a day to pick.
Complete newborn, straight yeah. away, straight into the church.
Complete newborn is in like the morning of, or...
I think so, or maybe the night before.
Really? Because, God, they move fast.
Well, so the newborn baby who was being baptised in Cloughead's church was christened Mary Jenny Hodges.
Lovely.
Daughter of Dennis Hodges and Catherine McGeaney. Now, Jenny was, as she was known by her middle name, we don't have huge amounts of detail.
I mean, you know, newborn in Ireland in the 1840s. We never have that much history on anyone who isn't royalty if they're a young age.
No, but not even. But it's quite late. 1843. By that point, things are starting to centralise in records. But,
well, I mean, as we've just said, I think records are probably going to take a hit in the next few years. So,
well, this is the thing. So, I think that is actually indicative of why we don't know so much.
Yeah.
Because I'm not convinced, because our story obviously is going to go to North America,
mm-hmm.
There is no definitive evidence of how it gets there.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
So a lot of, so this is our main character, who currently is known as Jenny,
mm-hmm.
and will soon be known as Albert.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And not just Albert Hodges, but Albert Cashier. So a completely different name.
Albert Cashier. Cool last name.
Yeah. So what's interesting about this is Al has always covered his tracks. about his origins. So there are he told different stories.
Understandably so.
Yeah, but he told different stories to different people who he was very close to.
Wow.
So I am not convinced of which is the... And the inner self-editor historian in me is going, no, you've got to tell them the right story. And I'm like, I don't know which is the real one.
Wow, he created his own legend with different conflicting stories and everyone tells a different tale.
Exactly.
I should do that. That's a great idea.
Honestly.
Just lie.
In this day and age, it's hard. But back then, you could do that and sort of get away with it, I guess. It sounds weird to say.
And, he's telling this story across the sea. So no one's going to check. No one's going to really be able to find
out. Exactly. But for whatever reason, Al's story wouldn't stay in Ireland for very long.
Mm-hmm.
So one story that is meant to have happened is his father dies quite early in young Al's life, and his mother remarries a man called Cashier.
Oh, okay, right. So surname. he didn't invent this last name. He got somewhere else.
This is possibly where Cashier comes from.
Do we know roughly how old Albert would have been at this point?
Nope.
No idea. Right,
literally no idea.
Okay.
Until he enrolls in the Union Army in 1862, I think, we have absolutely no records except for his birth.
Right. Okay.
So in between those two dates, in 1843 and 1862, his life is a complete legend.
Which is a shame because there's quite an important part of that life that I guess we never really know the hard details about how he came to be who he was and who he'd grow up to be.
Yeah.
Which is sad.
Yeah, I know, but I think that's what he would have wanted.
Yes.
It's self-imposed.
The air of mystery.
It's self-imposed. No, I think it's privacy. I don't think he wants to know.
I'm trying to be mysterious. You're trying
I think he just wanted to be left alone.
Yeah.
So he was a man of 5 feet tall and quite nimble on his feet. Everyone said it. He was a cutter dash as well. He was quite an attractive man. And so he told certain people. So he told in the walkthrough, I talked about his friend Charles Ives, who was a comrade in arms. He told his mate Charles that he had a twin brother. And that when they were growing up in Ireland, their mother dressed them both in boys' clothing so that they could both go out to work and bring in money, because this is before the child labour laws.
Oh, interesting.
So that's
I wonder how common that is. Presumably quite... I mean, if they've done it once, you'd presume it's not... you wouldn't assume it's a really rare instance. You'd assume it's quite a common instance and actually makes sense because people do... they don't... I guess interesting... Child labour laws, but I guess it's just frowned upon to send young girls to work.
Yeah.
So they would just go, and maybe they wouldn't get given work, also because people would be like, well, it's a girl, they're not going to be able to do anything.
Exactly.
So instead they send their girls dressed up as boys in order to do what society is deeming can only be done by a man.
Yeah. But also, I wonder whether the trauma, if Albert was still living in Ireland during the famine, which were his first years, because he was born in 43... The breakout is in 45. So by the time it's over in 52, he's 9. So was the trauma of watching an entire nation die, was that what solidified his identity as a man? Possibly. I don't know. Or, I don't know. There's no way of knowing.
I mean, there's a certain... People stick to... I guess people would stick to the rigid doctrine laws of the land in times of peace and prosperity and when things are going well. Whereas when things are falling apart and authority figures, the church, the community and stuff like that, aren't able to protect you in the way and aren't able to kind of withhold their side of the almost social arrangement everyone has with society.
Yeah.
Then you do lose faith in that, and then you lose faith in any kind of rules, either written down or kind of...
Imposed
by anyone.
Yeah.
So people are probably more willing to change who they are and resist against that and go in a different direction.
100%.
Possibly. I mean, it's, we could speculate.
Well, this is the thing. So just sort of to trot out a couple other alternatives in terms of this beginning of Albert's life. Another friend he told, again, right at the end of his life, is that he only assumed male garb in order to enlist... when he does enlist in the Union Army,
right,
to be with his lover.
Oh, okay.
So that's another story.
Right,
and
okay.
In that tale, this lover supposedly was killed early on in the war, and on their death, on his deathbed, said to Albert, "Please stay true to yourself and never again wear a dress." So that's
It's complicated there, because then you could look at it in terms of a practical sense, and especially if he grew up being dressed in boys' clothes because to fulfill a practical service for his family at a very important time when you need to do that, he then sees that as a reason to do that when he's in America and he wants to fight the good fight, and he couldn't be able to do that as a woman. But then, yeah, that comment about being your true self at the end.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it will be, you know, we will never be able to know. And it's probably going to be a bit of a mix as well. And actually, it would be easy to, and, you know, maybe Albert himself wasn't sure which side, you know, am I only doing this for practical sense, or is this who I am? Does it matter? Does it matter more than the practicality? Does it matter less than the practicality? Like, all these things swirl around people's heads whenever they do anything. It's like, you know, and also you kind of, especially if he's retelling his story, obviously for privacy reasons, but then you can kind of, people retell their stories all the time to then justify where they are. You know, I mean, people who write audiobiographies, you do it to explain where you have got to, and you do away with anything that doesn't explain where you got to, when actually life's a bit more messy than that.
True. And also, you've got to remember dementia. So he might not remember the true tale, and it's lost in his own mind.
Wow.
Because the other thing, so this is, there are still two more alternatives. Mm-hmm. He tells a psychiatrist, again, this is all happening at the end of his life, mm-hmm. that he was born in Cloverhead, which was true.
Mm-hmm.
So that's been confirmed. And as a child, had worked for his uncle, who was a sheep herder. And so that's sort of beside that's kind of from there, from his bio sort of thing, that he worked as a sheep herder with his uncle.
Mm.
And then he talks about how his mother had remarried a man called Cashier, as I said,
mm-hmm.
and made him dress as a boy in order to get him work in a shoe factory. So again, it's like, but is that happening in Cloverhead, or is that happening in New York? Because that could be a story that happened when he emigrated. So it's just,
there's so many interesting things to like look at here, because also I don't know if you would use the term trans in this scenario, because that's a more modern term. But if we were to use it, but also the trans experience would be different then purely by, I mean, both from stigma, although unfortunately you still get a lot of that nowadays, but also just in the terms of the reason you're doing that, and because there's such a divide between what's considered something men can do and what's something considered women can do.
Yeah.
The practicality side of it is so much more, and that maybe it's a common practice for women to take on this role to try and get ahead and to try and support their families for whatever reason. And it's not a personal choice, and then for some of it becomes a personal choice. Like it's an interesting landscape, and a very different landscape from today.
Yeah.
As to why you would want to do that. And I think, yeah, it's fascinating. And I think it's, I mean, you know, and it's also potentially just very, it's very heroic and very great for someone to do that and put their, I mean, arguably, I assume, life at risk. I mean, you mentioned it at the beginning.
Oh, yeah.
That they could get in a lot of trouble for that. And it could be considered awful by some people, and they will react horrendously to that. But if you're doing that, both if you're doing that for your own personal, the way you view yourself, or if you're doing it to kind of help out your family or necessity, in any way, it's courageous and to be willing to do that.
Yeah.
And so it's such a shame that we don't know more.
I know. Yeah. Also, I was like, okay, I work in this field, you know, genealogy, something I do.
You can
so
bring it out.
I found the same thing that has already been found there, birth certificate.
Mm-hmm.
So that's there. And I was like, okay, if he came into the US, I'll find him. Nope.
Really?
He claims in different versions of his story that he came over as a stowaway. So,
which you wouldn't be recorded for.
No, exactly. Mm. So it's impossible to know. All I can tell you is it looks like he did get to New York, and New York was where his journey in the US began. But was he 14, or was he nearer to 20? Because it's so hard to know how long it took him to get to the enlistment.
Oh, I see. So we know when he's enlisted.
Yeah.
And at some point between then, he makes the trip over from Ireland to New York, but we don't know how old is he.
Or anything.
Oh, wow.
And also...
complicated.
The famine in the way,
Yeah.
The other thing. He was one of the million who fled.
Exactly, yeah. And so, in fairness, he could have just come through perfectly legit, in a legit way, as everyone else did, and just records got lost, because you have so many people going through there.
Mm.
Not surprised at all if people lose records, or anything could happen, really, in that time.
Very true, very true. So either way, we can establish a hinge point being Chloe Head, Christmas Day, 1843. We know there's the famine. We know that Albert takes the journey in some form and picks up the name Albert Cashier at some point. The very next hinge point fact that we have is on the 4th of September, 1862, when Albert Cashier enlists in the Union Army in Belvidere, Illinois.
Right, okay. So 1862.
Yeah.
Where are we in the war at this point? Before?
No, so we're actually mid-war.
Mid-war.
So the war broke out on the 12th of April, 1861.
And I should know that. Yeah, I did a whole thing with Lincoln.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
And initially, the Union had a terrible time.
Yeah, yeah,
They lost lots and lots of battles, and it meant that suddenly Lincoln had to call on 300,000 volunteers to make new regiments, because all the professionals ones were torn to shreds.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And what's interesting about that is where Albert signs up is Belvidere, Illinois, as I said. And so anyone with any military experience in April 1861, when it started, right, they all join up, right? And they enlist in the 9th Illinois Regiment. Not volunteer regiment, regiment.
Right.
So the sort of the existing regiment for that state.
Yes.
Right? And a regiment has 1,000 men split into 10 companies of 100.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of if you're just thinking about the basis.
Yeah.
They march off to war, and at the Battle of Shiloh, it was the bloodiest battle of the Civil War up to that point, with an estimated 23,000 casualties in total.
God.
Which is huge for that time period as well.
That's a huge... Because the American Civil War is the biggest loss of... percentage-wise, the biggest loss of American life ever. I think also, because our Civil War is also the biggest percentage loss of...
Apart from the Battle of Towton, yes.
Yeah.
As a full war.
A full accounting. Because obviously, it's... Every death is a British death, and so every American death every death in the Civil War is an American death.
Yeah,
brutal. Is that also one of the battles where no one won?
Yeah,
there are loads of really bloody battles.
They're all messy, and they all
limp away and we're all worse off now.
100%. And this is the futility of the war, because it's the first war with machines, proper machinery being used. So you're no longer loading
muskets.
Pistol and shot. Yeah, muskets. You've got repeater rounds and things like that. You've got actual bullets.
And because it wouldn't be machine guns yet. It'd be Gatling guns.
Gatling guns.
I think that would be the version.
100%. And you had cannons,
which is terrifying. And they would still do kind of marches, a bit like Napoleonic and Revolutionary War time, where they're kind of just walking at bullets.
Yeah.
Because they haven't quite figured out...
We got trenches.
And
lots of trenches.
That's interesting. So they did start really employing trenches at this point.
Yeah.
I mean, as soon as you get cannons, you start getting trenches, don't you? Because they're we can't get out here.
But you also have these flying columns, so which are cavalry forces, which run through lines. So it's not like in World War One, everyone gets entrenched quite quickly. And then
they've got proper machine guns where they can just do 1,000 rounds a second.
But the cavalry units were shock troops in this war. They seemed to be flying all over the place, which meant they're really hard to tie down. And so they just rip through lines.
And I suppose the problem also with this war, if I might raise a problem with this war, because it's a civil war, both sides are pretty evenly matched in terms of technology. They're all using whatever the best that America had at the time, as opposed to it being very one-sided and therefore being one side just like... Because really, it's wars that are even that are terrible.
Because
it's like a meat grinder. They just keep sending people. Whereas wars where one side has an overwhelming majority, most of the time the other side retreats.
And it's a bit of guerrilla. Calls for peace or something.
Yeah, yeah. And then there's smaller skirmishes and maybe like sabotage and that kind of thing, but that doesn't kill thousands of people in one day.
No, exactly.
So it's a bloody, bloody time for America.
100%. And also, like I say, in the first couple of, year and a half, lots of professional soldiers just cease to exist. So then you're actually fighting with quite a lot of amateurs, and that obviously leads to more death, because they're actually not that good. And quite a few of the generals are pretty shit as well on both sides. So it's like they make terrible decisions. I think one of the quotes, one of those sort of quotes you see everywhere, which is like, it was from one of the generals. I can't remember which one it was. It was like, why are you all ducking down? They can't hit a barn door from here. And that was the last thing he said.
He got shot immediately.
Yeah, by a sharpshooter.
Classic.
So, you know, it's just a terrible, terrible war. But just to sort of go back to the 9th. So the 9th Illinois took 366 casualties in the Battle of Shiloh. When you think they marched out of Belvedere with 1,000 men.
Thousands. They lost a third.
Yeah.
Over and a third.
Shiloh at the time, in 1860, not Shiloh, sorry, Belvedere at the time, which is where they originated, had a population of 2,446.
Oh, man. So a sixth.
Yeah.
Just over a sixth of their population gone in a day.
And male. Just think about that. You halve that.
Yeah.
Probably, roughly. And so a huge number, right? And the guys who are still there, right? The guys who haven't signed up yet.
Oh, who are still in Belvedere.
Still in Belvedere. Mm. And they hear this news coming back that the 9th has been obliterated.
Mm.
Can you imagine the pressure?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
From just if you were an eligible man.
You know, they're losing, like, you know, make their sacrifice worth it.
And one such man was a young whippersnapper.
Mm.
5 foot nothing, literally.
Life on his feet.
Yeah, exactly.
Kind of perfect for this kind of combat,
handyman,
you know. Yeah.
Basically working on the street, not working on the street.
Nice and slim so you won't get shot. You know, you can turn sideways and you're less likely to get shot. Yeah. You know, you don't need big brutes on battlefields anymore with swinging greatswords.
Well, no, exactly. But the thing is, you've got to think, Albert probably doesn't... Well, we don't know. We don't know what Al wants to do, right? Whether he signs up because he hears Lincoln's speech for the call to arms and joins up, or he follows his lover into the fight.
Yeah.
But whatever the reason, I could imagine him feeling a little cautious trying to get into it.
I mean, he'd be a madman if he wasn't cautious.
Yeah, but I'm talking about revealing his biological sex, because if you're joining up into an army, you'll have a medical.
Mm.
And then everything could go pretty wrong pretty quickly, which might explain why he didn't join up earlier. Because this is
early on, they're checking for the best. So they want the best of the best. So the full medical examination. They wouldn't let anyone with any reason they couldn't join to join up, because they don't want them weakening the side.
Do you know what they checked in the medical?
What would they have checked?
Three things:
teeth.
Yeah.
Eyesight.
Nope.
That seems like an obvious one. Like, do they have to run for a bit and see if they can do anything?
No teeth, kind of Arabic. Toes, and fingers.
Fair, fair.
Because you need to march, you need to shoot.
The last one I was going to say was feet and toes and stuff, I suppose. Yeah, yeah. I suppose, like, do you need to be able to hear anything with a rifle? No, you just point. As long as you're pointing the right direction, that'll do it.
Yeah.
As long as you keep moving in the right direction. And teeth, because they always check teeth.
I guess they do, yeah, because it's like disease.
Yeah, yeah,
you can tell if someone's ill, very ill, I guess, if your teeth are rotting. Anyway, so... He went through that process and was signed off.
Blast through that process. Yeah.
And he was put down as fair-haired and 5'0" or 5'3". There's a couple of medical records, so we're not really sure which one's the real one. But we're talking about a diminutive man.
Yeah, yeah.
Obviously.
But, you know, there are lots of men born that short.
Yeah, no, of course. So, anyway, so he joined the 95th Illinois Volunteer Regiment.
Right, okay.
Which is different. It's like is the volunteer battalions.
Yeah, is the volunteer regiment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Albert and his 99 other men of G Company of the 95th Illinois...
99
marched off to Camp Fuller in Rockford, Illinois for 2 months of training.
2 months, that's quite a lot, actually.
Yeah.
I thought it would be a day. To be honest, it feels like
after that medical. From there, they then were sent south to join Ulysses Grant's army in Jackson, Tennessee.
Nice.
And they were flung literally straight into the Central Mississippi campaign.
Less nice.
Yeah, but I think the main thing to take away from this is it's not like Albert survived the war as much as Albert was involved in some of the worst fighting throughout the war. So it wasn't like he was able to sort of, even if he wanted to, sort of duck and hide.
Oh, I see.
He was an active, proactive
soldier. He was
soldier.
Right on the front line for some of the worst moments.
100%.
So, lucky is probably the only thing we can say.
And I mean, smart. Well, I think there's some smarts there. He's been having to survive for so long. He's probably survived the famine.
Yeah. So, I suppose that'll put you through it.
Do you know what I mean? And then survived the Atlantic crossing. through New York, up to Illinois. Like, that's quite a lot to have done in his young life.
He really is a survivor.
100%.
I mean, yeah, famine, ships, civil war. Just,
I know,
blinder.
And then even more, you wait. So lots of this was taken after it, because basically what happens is we get lots of this at the end of his life for reasons that will become clear later. Mm-hmm. But we know for a fact that we've got testimony from his fellow comrades of what kind of man he was like to fight with. And so I've got a couple of quotes here. So some of his comrades said he was really good at the long marches.
Okay.
And I think because he's fleet of foot, he didn't have, I don't know, maybe he was just a little bit more, he was used to not eating very much because of the famine probably.
Oh, and so
he was just like made of steel.
Irish build them strong.
100%.
To withstand the British.
Yeah. If, for instance, there was ever some like heavy lifting to be done, he would get a husky, I'm quoting now, a husky comrade would assist him in handling any heavy assignment. And in return, he would help that soldier with chores like washing clothes and replacing buttons.
Oh, interesting.
Because he was good at that.
And I suppose that wouldn't give... I mean, you know, soldiers... There will be lots of soldiers that would have to get better at what would, at the time, probably be perceived feminine skills, like laundry and sewing and stuff like that. Because there are no women... Well...
There aren't that many.
There aren't really women. There are hangers-on and stuff like that. There aren't really women around. And, you know, you don't want to rely on someone else. It's easy if you just sew a button back on.
Yeah, that's 100%. Good. He was also apparently one of the best shots in the company.
Ooh.
So that's a good... So he can make up for his slight stature by being good at shooting.
You get away with anything if you're... Good shooters are always cool in armies, aren't they?
Yeah, but also, interestingly, and this does make sense, but another thing that was said about him was he was not a big talker. And wouldn't hang out much with the other soldiers. He was much more likely to be found smoking a pipe and appearing to have thinking of distant places on his mind. So he wouldn't sit at the campfire with the
sounds
lads.
Sounds like Aragorn.
Yeah, he does.
Like sitting in a corner with a pipe.
Yeah. But that's what he'd do.
Mysterious. These are like, they're all adding up to, if you were a new person to the regiment or your meeting, you wouldn't want to mess with him. Because like, good shot, bit mysterious, quite smoking a pipe.
The silent type.
Got the respect of the other men around him.
100%.
Yeah, you wouldn't mess with him. And that's probably a good persona to build if you are hiding a very dangerous secret.
Yeah, exactly. And so things started. Let's talk about his war.
Yeah.
Because it's really quite incredible. So the first thing is the walkthrough. So Vicksburg, that was a siege where the Confederates, so the South, were holding Vicksburg, right?
Okay.
Vicksburg sat on the Mississippi River and was known as the Gibraltar of the Mississippi.
Really?
Yeah, because it could control all traffic on the Mississippi. So it was closed to the Union. And so they had to take it in order to break the South's lines in two.
And is it like an island within the Mississippi?
I think it might be just next to the Mississippi, but it acted like a bulwark that stopped all trade. Like the Straits of Gibraltar was able to just like hold, you can just tax anyone coming through it.
Yes.
Whatever the reason, Vicksburg needed to be taken. Mm-hmm. And the walkthrough at the beginning is taken from that.
Mm.
So Al was known, he was known as Al by loads of his friends. It wasn't Albert, it was Al. He was quite often picked for reconnaissance and foraging missions by Captain Bush.
Light of foot?
Yes, light of foot and deadly shot. I mean, why wouldn't you? Also quite small, nimble.
I assume reconnaissance, you wouldn't be shooting.
But if you needed to get out of a tight spot, you want to have someone who would be relied on.
Yes.
And this is what happened actually at Vicksburg. So the siege was absolutely brutal, leading to a total butcher's bill of almost 50,000 casualties. This is huge amounts of men.
Do you know which side, presumably mostly on the Yankee side because they're trying to take it?
Yeah.
It could even be like 10,000.
Yeah. It was a bloodbath.
Yeah.
And Al, at one point, was sent on a reconnaissance mission, and whilst he was out with his patrol, he was captured by Confederate soldiers.
My God.
And incredibly, he managed to overpower the guard and beat him with his own rifle.
Oh my God.
Knocking him out and then making his way back to friendly territory at night, which is what I based the walkthrough on.
What a hero move.
Yeah. But also, it does make sense. The determination for him to do that isn't just because he wants to get back to...
much more danger.
Yeah. It would absolutely have ruined...
Because it could have been anything. It could have been being discovered by the Confederate soldiers and treated awfully.
Yeah.
He could have ended in his death, but it could have ended his relationship with his fellow soldiers. Like, even if he had been revealed and his secret had gotten out, even if they had managed to fight their way back, his then time in the army is done. He could have been arrested. I mean, the legality here, I assume. I mean, lying to commanding officer. I mean, I don't know if... Presumably they wouldn't ask that question. They wouldn't ask, were you born a woman?
Well, I guess it's
also... Is there anything else medically you need to tell us?
They would see it as deceptive.
I mean, they would not react well and could very easily end up in jail or worse. And also, it's your entire life and your entire identity. You're now a soldier and, the bonds you form in those arenas. I mean, well... Do we have any... I mean, I suppose we wouldn't, but we wouldn't have any indication about if any of his fellow soldiers knew.
We do know.
Ooh.
And they didn't.
Really? They had no idea?
Well, there's a couple of things that come up, which I'll get to.
Okay.
This was obviously a lucky escape, right?
Yes.
He gets through it. But actually, an even luckier one, straight afterwards, right? He just gets back. And I know this is going to sound a bit weird, but he contracted diarrhea.
Ugh.
But this is deadly.
Who doesn't?
This is deadly.
Yeah.
Because actually, this is unbelievable, right? This is unbelievable, this stat, okay? The number one killer.
Oh, God. It's always this. It's always this.
U.S. Civil War. So the total number of soldier deaths in the U.S. Civil War was 660,000, right? Guess how many died from diarrhea and dysentery?
Oh.
So 660,000.
I mean, I don't know. Is it?
It's approximate.
Is it over half?
Yeah.
Is it a lot over half?
It's 440,000.
It's over two thirds.
It's roughly two thirds.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So actually, him escaping what could have ended in his death by a bullet was actually just the beginning of almost. Dying by the stats later of diarrhea.
What's the point of war if this is like it's just cause it's interesting we know that fact.
Yeah.
Because surely no one at the time, none of the high command of either side would want anyone to know that if you go to war, chances are you'll die.
But I think people knew. I think it was endemic. It happened all the way through Europe. All the European wars are the
dysentery?
Same.
It's dysentery, but
it's extreme diarrhea. It's basically what happens. You die of dehydration. Basically.
And it's just them. It's just they're poorly supplied.
No, it's not that. They wouldn't dig. They dug latrines too close to water sources. They didn't understand that microbial bacteria would get into the water supply.
It's just a shame because they're quite close knowing.
Very close.
Really, because London's starting to figure it out.
Yeah, the typhoid.
1840, I'm trying to remember.
1860.
Is it 1860? Sorry, 1860.
Yeah.
Well, it's even closer because I feel like, because it's by the turn of the century, that is well established and people understand that.
Probably as a result of things like the US Civil War.
Yeah. Oh, that's such a shame. And just so...
But again, think about this, right? You are a biological... You've got a secret, right? You're a biological woman. You get diarrhea.
Mm.
You are put into the field hospital because if you've got it, it spreads.
Yeah.
So you've got to be taken away from your comrades, right?
Oof.
So somehow... And this, again, he is so clever and just thinks quickly on his feet. Real survivor. He managed to convince the field hospital doctor... to make him an outpatient.
Right. Okay.
And what that did, there were two outcomes of that. It meant that...
Outpatient how? What do you mean? Like just
not
like,
put in the hospital.
But could just go somewhere else and would have a doctor come to him.
He would have to check in with the doctor.
Oh, I see. Right.
But he wouldn't have to lie in a bed next to his fellow men and get a medical examination, which would then reveal his biological sex.
Yes.
So he's an outpatient, so he can go to the toilet wherever he needs to.
Mm-hmm.
And... by not being in that hospital, he's probably saved his life.
Yeah.
Because people are dying by going to the hospital.
Oh, yeah.
So, again, avoids one of the chief killers of this war just by thinking on their feet and also because of the obvious dangers if he'd been found out.
Man,
so, honestly.
Smart guy.
Yeah.
God, I mean, how do you convince them? And how come you... Because surely... I guess there's actually... I suppose most soldiers wouldn't want to do that.
No.
They would want to go and lay up. I want to be with the doctors. Even then, they might not realize that actually that's more dangerous because there's more of a spread of disease within the hospitals because they don't know. They don't know how to wash. They don't know how to keep everything clean.
Yeah.
But most people would think, no, I need to be by the doctors. Also, it's just like, I want to be lying in a bed. I want to be tended to.
But this is the thing, right? It's the same with when he gets captured, right? If you were a male soldier, a biologically male soldier, mm-hmm. and you get captured by the Confederates, you'd be fine. You wouldn't be in any sort of excess danger.
No.
You would be taken to a prisoner of war camp and you'd sit out the war,
mm-hmm.
right? But he can't do that. So just for exactly the same reason as if he was biologically male, he can't just relent to the whims of his situation. He has to be proactively getting out of those situations wherever possible.
And then it's just, I mean, we come back to the why, and we'd love to, and I want to know why he did this because arguably he has an out.
Mm-hmm.
That most other soldiers don't have. He can, you know, and it might require him denying who he is, which
that's what I think it comes down to.
Yeah, shouldn't have to have done that to get out of war, but like he does have that option, and so it's amazing that he doesn't.
There's two things there. I think the first and most core one is he is Al, not Jenny.
Yes,
and he has been as long as he can remember.
Right.
And he does not, I don't think, want to change. That's who he is, right?
Mm.
And then the other thing is, I think he's very, very tight-knit with G Company.
Yeah.
He makes friends for life in that company, as you'll see at the end of this.
Yeah.
So, like, that you bond in battle, and you don't want to go back. And also, he probably didn't ever have that many friends before this, because he's a stowaway.
Mm.
He hasn't come over with his family.
Mm.
So there's very little contact. He can't make close friendships.
Yeah.
Either with women or with men, arguably. No. So suddenly there's an identity.
You need a battle and war is a good time to make very close relationships, and also everyone's a bit distracted. So like, you know, people aren't necessarily suspicious of outsiders because they're not an outsider. They're someone who's been randomly assigned to your regiment.
Yeah.
It's an easy way in. I also assume there's a certain amount of advancement. That's still a thing where, like, you know, especially for immigrants.
They'd get paid, aren't they?
So they get a pension. So they get something out of it. And, you know, they've come from destitute in Ireland because of the famine.
Yeah.
Probably not doing, and, you know, will be mistreated in the US as well because they're immigrants and that always happens. So this is a good way of becoming, fully qualifying yourself as American. Getting a pension, getting people who you know, trust you and rely on you, and you know, you can rely on them. So there's so much, but there is benefits to going to war.
Yeah.
But it's just, you know, he's just got this huge risk that he's willing to take for everything.
100%. Now, I've got a few more anecdotes from his time in the forces.
Love it.
So he was known, he didn't keep his head down. He really didn't.
Which you think you would.
I think he was thinking, if I'm going to go out, he might have got sick of this, of holding on to this secrecy. Mm. And I think he just wanted to, if he was going to live, he was going to do it his way.
If he's going to be Albert, he should be fully Albert.
Yeah.
Go
so
balls to
Al, wall. Al was,
as it were.
Yeah, he was known for being fearless. One of his comrades, Charles Ives, again, the guy who I mentioned at the beginning, recalled, and I quote, "One time when our column got cut off from the rest of the company because we were too outnumbered to advance, there was a place where three dead trees piled up on top of one another formed a sort of barricade for the Confederates." So mm-hmm. like this barricade. "The rebels got down out of sight. Al hopped on the top of the log, so ran forward and ran to their barricade and hopped on top of it and went, 'Hey, you darn rebels, why don't you get up where we can see you?'" Like, can you imagine, like, calling them out?
Oh, fantastic.
Like, yeah. And another time,
And he didn't get shot immediately.
Well, I guess he ran back to his lines.
And stunned silence.
Yeah, you know what it's like?
And I've had this in my head as we've been talking about this, because it really reminds me of Band of Brothers.
Oh, yeah.
Just the way they're talking about the comradeship. And then, Spears?
Yeah, no, Captain Spears, yeah. When
he runs all the way.
I mean, and then comes back.
And that's true, isn't it? Because all of that's true, isn't it?
Yeah.
So it's just that kind of, soldiers don't expect that. And they're not like, and especially as on the other side, I assume, are also probably immigrants, conscripts, volunteers. They're not necessarily professional soldiers.
Yeah.
So they just see some Yankee run up, yell at them, and they're like, bloody hell, we got, they probably wouldn't say bloody hell, that's very English.
Bloody hell.
Bloody hell.
Well, actually, the Brits supported the South, but we won't go into that. another time, right, he gained distinction by climbing a tall tree to attach the Union flag to a limb after it had been shot down by the enemy.
Oh, wow. Well, so actually, it sounds like, I mean, you know, loyalty to your country?
Yeah.
Council's country. Yeah, side of the it's their country and these are rebels.
Yeah.
But so there's a lot of loyalty there as well, and that he's willing to do. I mean, you know, that also might be a kind of part of his unit and a bit of a fuck you to the other side.
Yeah.
But still, I mean, that's
I'm getting that sort of nimble monkey type
guy. Springing. I mean, yeah, running along the thing,
jumping up,
leaping up in
trees, jokes like.
And again, it's, you know, it's probably also showing his worth when he's not as physically strong as the others.
Yeah.
And so it's, you know, it's showing your worth.
If
in
you're
that
showing
way.
You're fearless,
yes.
Don't ask you questions.
Yeah.
You know
what
I mean?
And people would just not, they wouldn't distrust him at all.
Yeah. 100%.
He's a hero.
And actually, so I said at the beginning, Captain Bush, right? So Captain Bush was a real person. He was the head of G Company. And he would select Al, as I said, for foraging and skirmishing missions, right? And this is a quote. Owing to the soldiers, so to Al's rigorous health and apparent abandon. So not reckless, but sort of, I don't care about enemy bullets. Kind of. I think actually Al, it was a natural soldier.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
Steely, knew how to survive in a tight spot.
Yeah. Like, I mean, clearly not like good under pressure and able to hold their nerve and move beyond it in times of absolute horror.
Yeah.
Which is not natural and not normal. And like, you know, it's we hero size and like I say fetishize, that's probably a bit of a mean word, but like war and that kind of thing because it's so big a part of our culture. But it's not a normal state of being, and it's perfectly normal that most people can't deal with it because you shouldn't have to deal with it.
No.
But there's extraordinary people who can. But as you say, might be less just who he was, but more what he's been through.
Exactly.
He's been through the Irish famine, which is enough to go through.
Yeah.
And he's had this secret all his life. He's had to be fearless. He's had to be courageous.
100%. And actually, the book, Captain Bush goes on to say, I gave Al all the regular duties of an infantryman, not knowing that she was a girl. This is a quote.
Yeah.
Not knowing that she was a girl, I assigned her to picket duty and to carry water, just as all the other men did.
Oh. So... I mean, we're getting a bit of a spoiler of the fact that at some point he knew.
This will come out. Yeah, well, the only way we know this story.
I suppose, yeah.
It wouldn't have happened.
I mean, that's a really big question about all the other... anyone else we know from history could have just been a much more secretive trans person.
Yeah, 100%. Well, this is interesting because actually there were... Now, this is interesting, actually. When you look at the historiography of Albert Cashier, there's a little bit of a contention between... I think, personally, he falls into proto-trans. So he is a trans person.
Yes.
But lots of the historiography is that he belongs to a group of women who dressed as men to go and fight in the Civil War.
Right.
And that I don't agree with.
Yes.
Because they then went back
to
being in women in the gender, the traditional gender roles after the war ended. Whereas Al didn't.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. It's back to what we were saying about like kind of practicalities versus your belief, your view of yourself.
Yeah.
Your belief in yourself.
100%.
Now, the other ones are more like Mulan.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. But it's a really interesting moment, right? So during one of their recruitment drives, G Company got a couple of new recruits. A new wave came through after a certain amount of time. And there was some suspicion of some women being in these recruits. So do you know, and I can't believe this is true, but it apparently is, and I'm going to quote this. So this is from Charles Ives again. He recalls that two women disguised themselves as men and were caught out in Al's presence.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, I'm not saying, I don't think Al was talking to them.
The term they use, in Al's presence.
I think it was the whole unit's presence. So Al just saw this happening.
Right. And he's just making the point because now in retrospect, he knows how important that. But at the time, it wasn't like they were. It was not like it was linked to him.
Not at all. And look, this is the quote. So he says, one day, right, this is a quote. One day, an officer threw apples to six fellows of the company. Four of them caught them man fashion. which I presume means with their hands. But the girls, dressed in military uniform, forgot and made a grab for their aprons. So if you imagine you catch apples from trees, the apples would be picked and dropped into the aprons of women.
Wow.
And they
Okay, so it's not, I thought he was being quite sexist, but it's less, it's kind of sexist, but like there is a legitimate reason why they wouldn't use their hands. They are more used to using an implement that they would do professionally.
So they kind of, their motor brain went for their apron, even though they weren't wearing them. And anyway, so the next morning, the sergeant had two less people to assign to duty because they'd been mustered out of the forces. But there was never a doubt about the fellow cashier. So that's what it said. That's the full quote.
Because he did a sweet like catch off the cuff.
But he must have looked at, he must have, can you imagine how close that must have been? You know what I mean? Not
terrifying.
That he'd ever used an apron, because he's been a man for his whole life.
And I guess, yeah, that's the difference, is that that's his identity.
Yeah.
The other women, you know, very courageous as well. Like,
of course.
Amazing what they're doing as well. But they that's not their identity. They are more lying.
Yeah.
Whereas by our standards, Albert isn't lying.
No.
It's just by their standards, they wouldn't have been okay about the way he was born.
Yeah.
But by our standards, he is a man. He is acting like a man. He's playing the masculine role in that society, as every other man is doing. But the women are doing something different.
Yeah.
That's so interesting.
Really interesting.
Because it's also like Inglourious Basterds. You know, the three and three.
Oh, the three and three.
Sounds like that kind of story.
It's that kind of slip.
Also, is there any indication that that's why they did it? Or was it just like someone threw some apples and then that came out? Or like,
no,
it wasn't a test.
I think there was quite a lot of women doing this. So
it
was
a bit
of a thing.
It must have come out and people were like, you need to find out. I mean, interesting. But I guess the thing is whether or not people like the generals. Yeah, no, they wouldn't. I think being Christian and being the society they would have been, they wouldn't want women fighting for them, either because they didn't think they could do it or because they thought women shouldn't be here. We shouldn't put women on the front line.
Yeah.
You know, we're losing enough men.
Well, there would have been all that stupid nonsense about, oh, it would be a distraction for the men.
Yeah.
We can't keep them safe. You know, all of that stuff.
All the classic stuff, yeah.
So, yeah, the misogyny is rampant.
So they're probably trying to ferret them out.
Yeah.
But then hilarious that their techniques of ferreting out people reaffirm Albert's position because he passes it.
Well, there is one slip in his armour. And this is, again, recalled later. So it wasn't, at the time, picked up on.
By
Ives. So Ives is one of his best mates.
Yes.
Al's best mates. So he recalls one time where they were taken into barracks, and I quote, "All of the bunks were doubles, but over in one corner there was a single cot, and Al asked me if he might have that cot. Mm-hmm. I consented and thought nothing about it at the time, but knowing now what I know, they wanted."
Yeah.
Because I also am just thinking practically, right? Periods.
Yeah.
I don't even know what they used back then for periods.
Just cloths.
Cloths, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But can you imagine, maybe Al got his period or something. It's such an interesting, because you just think about the hygiene of these places.
Mm.
I just think it's fascinating. The fact,
I mean, it's also a danger to,
where do you wash?
Because
everyone, you would have dived into rivers.
No, and none of the guys are probably like avoiding being seen by everyone else. Because why would you put effort in putting?
Well, I think that's why he's so distant. So he keeps his distance.
Yes,
from the fire, he keeps his distance.
I mean, but it's also in so much danger because also as little as washing they were doing back then, they were doing some.
Yeah,
but if he's having to avoid wash, it's even more danger that he's going to get sick and ill. And
but also going for a piss. Yeah. I know it sounds crude, but I imagine if your unit, you go
together.
All
the biology of this
together.
Is complicated. Yeah.
You know, you just go piss up a tree or whatever, like whatever guys would do. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And he would never have been able to do that. So it's just, I don't know. I find it incredible.
They like day after day, you have to do that. You have to play this role, and to just be able to avoid anyone finding out. It's hard. It's exhausting, and I can't imagine doing that.
No. It's really, really insane. Now, I'm not going to go into much more of this war because it's interminable, all these battles. But essentially, I didn't really know this. So the 95th is fighting on the western side of the fight, mm-hmm. right? But actually, the war was won in the east.
Mm.
So Ulysses Grant, General Grant, basically won the war over in the east, whilst Albert and the 95th are in the west.
Right, okay.
So they're sort of tied up over there in sort of Mississippi and Alabama and Georgia,
yeah.
whilst it was all going on in the Carolinas on the other
yes,
side.
Yes, yeah.
So essentially, he won the war. So General Grant won the war in the east, and then Albert and his comrades had fought for 3 years straight, from 1862 to 1865, and they'd marched almost 10,000 miles.
Oof.
Almost entirely on foot.
God.
And then they took, so of his 1,000 volunteers, they took 289 casualties. So 28% of the regiment.
Man, a lot.
Yeah. And so they then, that was almost 3 out of the 10 companies, if you think about it.
Yeah, yeah,
which
yeah.
is a lot. They then marched right back up to Illinois, right back to Belvedere, and had a hero's welcome, of course, for being mustered out of the army, because these are volunteer battalions or volunteer regiments, so they're not part of
the
professional army. So they all have to be demobbed, of course. Because I always thought that was a bit like, oh, you know, why couldn't they kind of carry on?
Carry on, yeah.
But then you'd have thousands of veterans with arms.
Like, well, because you need the army to go back to work. You don't want career politics. You don't want all going, oh, just stay here and then don't.
With guns.
Yeah, with guns.
They just had an insurrection.
Yeah, yeah. They don't need that. And also, the men need to go back to their jobs for any of the settlements to survive and for the economy to recover.
Yeah.
They can't just have a standing army.
No, of course not.
With nothing to support them.
But can you imagine being Al? So he found his position.
Purpose. Yeah.
Yeah, he knew. He had his friends, and then everyone went back to their homes, to their lives. Because these are volunteers, so they were doctors, they were lawyers, they were, you know, they were whatever they were. They went back, and he didn't really have a position.
No.
And so he went back, and also, I forgot to say, illiterate. Never had an education.
Really?
Couldn't read, couldn't write.
Well, I mean, it's not too surprising, but...
Actually, quite not that surprising, but... It was a hindrance by this point.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, if you're growing up in during the famine, though...
Or over in New York. I mean, we don't know where he grew up. But anyway...
I suppose that time period we don't know about, so it could be.
So, but he stayed in Belvedere for a short time, which is kind of in the north. It's right on the border with Wisconsin, so north of Chicago.
Does he have... Because I think you mentioned that he had a lover that he may have followed in. Is that just, like, vaguely mentioned, or do we know about who that
no,
person
we
is?
Have nothing else.
No more information. None. So, good that person could have died. And
well,
that,
in that story, he does die at the
oh,
beginning.
Really?
Of
oh, of
thing.
Course, yeah, yeah. And
says,
be true,
be true to yourself.
Interesting. But so not necessarily like the love of his life or anything like that.
No.
Just someone
going we are pretty sure that Al never had a relationship after that. There's certainly no record of it.
Well, who would you trust?
Well, exactly. Because we don't know, we can only speculate on the sexuality of Al. Because maybe he liked men or women, or neither. Maybe he was asexual. We literally have no idea.
Yeah.
But there isn't a partner that... we know of.
Does the mention of his lover or his partner come from him, or does it come from someone else?
No, it comes from him.
And he uses the term lover?
Yeah, well, it comes, yeah, from the way it's been written. I don't have it as a quote from him as his lover. But if that would imply that he was... Well
if it's just companion, though, it could have been just like a very close friend, like the only person who knew his secret, which, you know, it doesn't necessarily indicate a romantic relationship.
But it makes me wonder... That story, right? I've only got it from one source. Or I think I've got it from a few sources, but like the original, right? Is it the historians trying to fit the story out of trans? So it's actually a woman following a man into the army to be together.
Cis washing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Cis washing. So
I don't
just,
know if that's a term, but it sounds...
But
it
sounds...
Be.
That's a good term. I haven't heard that.
It should
before.
Be. I'm sure that's a good way of... sure that is used. But yeah.
It could be that. I don't trust that story.
Yeah. I mean, you know, and it could be, but it I think it's...
He strikes me as someone who's quite solitary because he has to be.
Mm.
And I don't think, I don't know. But then he was very young. He was like 20,
I mean, you know,
18, I think, when he joined up.
And, you know, asexuality is definitely a possibility, 19. But it is rare, you know, and I think so. But it's just, it's probably just a case of that he wouldn't really be able to trust anyone.
No.
And I think, you know, the sacrifices people have to make to be true to who they are. And if he has to do that, and if he's clearly thriving in the army, you know, he's found his purpose, he's found his way of life.
Yeah.
If you don't, if taking kind of a romantic path also puts that at risk, maybe he never would.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
It's just such a risk because it's, you know, you're putting your entire livelihood and quite literally your life in someone's hands.
Yeah.
And you wouldn't know until you did it.
No, exactly.
Until you revealed it, you would have no idea. They could be They could be super close to you. They could even be in their mind, if he met a guy who he considered himself gay and they had a relationship, you still don't know how they'll react, because even if they are on maybe the fringes or they're worried about people reacting to them, that doesn't mean, you know, you're going to be an ally for everyone.
No, exactly. That's the thing. It's so dangerous. It's so unquantifiably dangerous.
So I wonder if, yeah, if that is maybe a description. And I wonder if also it might also link up to other stories of women during war, actually, yeah, who just, you know, maybe slightly more brash and a bit more tomboyish than others and willing to go to war. And they were like, I don't want to lose you. Yeah. And, you know, maybe, you know, possibly married, but not with kids, so they don't feel like they need to go back. And they're like, no, I prefer to come with you. We can look out for each other. So maybe they're trying to fit that story into Albert's.
They're trying to, like, copy-paste it.
But so much else feels different because of the he doesn't go back.
No. Ever. It doesn't fit, I don't think.
Yeah. He found who he was.
I've got to show you one. There's quite a few photos of Albert.
Oh, fantastic.
But I want to show you one. I want your opinion as someone who hasn't seen him before, because for the listeners to sort of see what you see.
And listeners, these pictures will be on the Instagram. So if you're listening to this, go to @CloakandDaggerPodcast and check out these images so you can see them along with me and react as I react.
So that is Al with, I don't think that's Charles Ives, but it's someone,
he
I think.
Just looks like a dude.
Yeah. But yeah. Slight, quite slight.
Very slight. His left hand looks,
I think
it's just is it just clenched?
I think it's not
it's not like damaged or disfigured.
But, you know,
the other guy is giving a lot of face. I like that.
Yeah, he looks like a Clint Eastwood,
slightly mad in the eye. Yeah, yeah.
That monobrow.
It's how I imagine Ahab to look in Moby Dick.
Yeah,
just slightly mad. That kind of beard. Yeah, I like him a lot.
But he's got, so the bearded man, as you'll see on the Instagram, has his hand on Al's shoulder. And I think that's a really nice, it's like, I'm going to defend him. Mm. Like, this guy's big, right? This guy's big, as you said, husky big man. This looks protective.
It does, yeah.
Like, a bit like, you know what it reminds me of? You know, like, cabin boys to pirate ships?
Yes.
The guy who would scramble up into the eagle's nest.
Yes, yeah.
That relationship.
Sort of very, like, valuable, not big and burly and hyper-masculine in that kind of way, but there's an appreciation for talent and for what they can provide. And
yeah.
That kind of thing. And that kind of, that's the thing. In times of war, in times of real crisis, all bullshit, masculinity, hyper, all that kind of stuff, alpha male, that all falls away because it's always bullshit anyway.
Yeah.
So you realize, actually, you don't, if you rely on that, you're going to get yourself killed and everyone around you killed. Whereas 100%. If you rely on just, like, trusting people, understanding people's talents, appreciating people for those talents, then that's how you survive.
Yeah.
So then it all falls away. And so it makes sense why they would be like, you know, in other scenarios. And then that's maybe why Albert liked being in the army so much, because that stuff comes flooding back as soon as you come back to normal society.
Yeah. So just to sort of not wrap this up, but get to the next step, Al stayed working in Belvedere for a short while, working for a man called Samuel Pepper as a handyman.
Okay.
But then he drifts, and he, in 1869, so what's that, 4 years after the end of war, he heads south, about 100 miles south, and settles in a place called Saunemin, Livingston County, Illinois. So it's now south of Chicago,
right?
Essentially. And there, I'm not quite sure why he settles there, but he does. And he gets work as a farmhand and as a handyman for the Chesbro family.
Okay.
Now, he works for this family, or he certainly lives and works in Saunemin for the next 40 years.
Wow, okay.
And at the beginning, now remember, he has no family, so no money.
No.
And he hasn't got his pension yet, because his pension doesn't come through till he's in his 60s.
You get paid, though. He'd have some money from the army.
Not yet. The pension doesn't come in until he's 64.
Do they only get a pension? They don't get paid?
No, because he's mustered out. He's not in the army.
Oh, I suppose you only get paid. I suppose you would have run out of money, because you get paid to live.
Yeah.
And then you leave and you run out. Oh, interesting.
So that's why
he becomes, I suppose, yeah, unless he had savings, but that's... Who's having savings? Yeah.
So anyway, so he starts working for the Chesbro family, and he actually starts working, and they give him a place to sleep in their hardware shop. This is how poor Albert is. Mm. He doesn't have any savings. So he works
poor veterans, isn't it? They're not looked after at all.
No, not at all. So he works in there. And then in 1885, so we're skipping really far ahead now. So 16 years after working for this family, the Chesbro family, they build him a house.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah.
For him, just for him. And so he lives there and then carries on working for the Chesbro family.
Handyman's an interesting trade for someone who potentially can't lift as much as right? Man.
Well, he also became, he did a range of jobs. So he lives, as I say, in Sandeman for 40 years and he worked as a janitor, a cemetery worker, a lamplighter, and then he becomes a mechanic and then later a chauffeur.
Very interesting. Yeah. A chauffeur?
Yeah.
For very early cars?
Yeah, exactly.
Wow, that's pretty cool.
Well, I presume late carriages and early cars, because you could just have a driver.
Also. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I suppose chauffeur. But he's a mechanic.
Yeah.
And the unless that's he's working true. On trains.
Well, it could be trains, yeah.
Could be trains, but that's...
But I think it's cars.
It feels like it. I mean, we're now... What year? 19...
Well, now it's right up to the 1890s, which 1900s.
There are cars.
There are cars. There's flight.
There's flight.
Not very much of
which
it.
Is it. But it's very weird how actually close it is. It's not long after we get cars that we get flight as well. And then also not that long after we land on the moon.
Yeah.
And then nothing since then. But like, yeah, no, that's interesting. I assume it would be cars, but also mechanic, great job for someone who's small with small hands.
100%.
Really, really useful.
But here's the thing, he's clearly clever. He's naturally talented. Clever and quick. Otherwise, he wouldn't have lasted as long as he did.
Also, handyman, any service job, if they're quiet and distant, most people prefer
perfect.
That, you know?
Yeah. Well, same with chauffeur.
Chauffeur as well.
You want an anonymous...
Are Americans like that, though? Would be like that.
I think they were. But no, so the other thing to remember is because he was deemed to be a biological man, Al was entitled to vote.
Oh, wow.
Long, long, long before
anyone
trans or a woman could vote, he was voting in elections.
Oh, that's such a... That would be a... I mean, you'd never know it, but it'd be a wonderful stat to know... Like every election in the US and in the UK and places, what percentage of it is actually women who have managed to trick the system,
but it's like,
or living a life as a man or doing something.
You know, the stoning in Life of Brian. It's like all the beards. Yeah, are there any women here?
It's only women.
Yeah, it's just women stoning men. I love it.
That would be hilarious, right? It's like, turns out through most of history, despite not having the vote, most of the vote has come from women because men are lazy and just can't bother to do anything.
Yeah,
like, they're the actual ones running everything.
Yeah. So his pension kicked in 1907, which was when he was 64 years old.
Wow.
Which is a long time since he joined in when he was in his 20s. Oh, he was a teen. I think he was 19 when he enlisted. So, but he gets his pension.
And you get it once he hits a certain age, yeah.
Yeah, but I'm not sure if they even kicked in. I don't know if pensions existed pre-1907, because it's around that time that pensions stopped kicking in. State pensions start kicking in the early 1900s.
So they did it retroactively. I mean, I suppose it would make sense to do it retroactively. They hadn't had a war to give war pensions.
Exactly. Now... Yeah. The crux of why we know this story is what happens in 1911.
Okay.
In 1911, Al is working for the state senator of Illinois, a man called Ira Lish.
Right.
Which is a great name, Ira.
Working for as?
A mechanic and chauffeur.
Oh, lovely.
And I...
So, definitely car.
Yeah.
Because if he's a senator,
History doesn't relate quite how this happened, but Lish hit Albert... with his car.
Okay.
I'm not sure how, but it broke his leg.
Hopefully accidentally.
No, I'm sure it was, because he was a good employer, and he probably clearly liked Al.
Hit or partially ran over, because it could have been he was working on the car in the back and
leg.
You have a wheel going over your leg would break it. Like.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure, but basically, breaks leg, he's 64, 65.
Oh, God, yeah, I'd forgotten. Yeah, it's super old.
So what does Ira do? He is obviously filled with guilt and foots the bill for this as well, obviously. Mm. Chucks him into the back of that car, takes him to the local doctor and says, I've just broken my fellow's leg.
Oh, my God.
And then...
It's revealed.
Wow. Now, not publicly, though.
So Lish is a good guy and keeps
Lish
it under wraps.
And the doctor and Al... make a pact, or not a pact, but to keep his secret.
Well, what's the point? Like, what's the point in releasing it? And obviously, so he'd been working for him a long time. Like, why? Also, Lish is guilt-ridden that he's probably ended his career as a mechanic. I mean, repairing bones back then is not great.
But there's also a problem here. He's now an invalid because his leg isn't going to get better.
Mm.
So he can't work.
Yeah.
So Lish engineers, or doesn't really engineer, he just solves the problem, which is that he gets taken to the Soldiers and Sailors Care Home in Quincy, Illinois, which is like the nearest town. So that was for war veterans. So he could live there and have his pension, right?
And still under wraps.
Still under wraps. So he gets there on the 5th of May, 1911. And he is getting his pension, as I say. And he's enjoying living at Quincy. But he's starting to get dementia.
Oh.
So things are starting to unravel. I bet he wished he died earlier. You know what I mean?
Before he became an invalid. Wish he might
he's now trapped.
Might have hoped the card killed him. And yeah, actually, that's an okay way to die. Like, it's, you know, it's he's old now. He's happy.
Yeah. But so he's then in Quincy, right? Mm-hmm. And then it transpires that they've worked out that he's not a man.
Well, I mean, you would need you need medical attention and maybe him saying certain things.
And at first, it's okay. Like, he must have been pleading with the nurses and the doctors to keep his secret like he had in the local doctor. And it was a visit from a Catholic fucking priest that changed everything.
Great.
He hears about it.
They're always great, aren't they, in all stories?
Yeah. And Albert was quite happy in that care home. Everyone said it.
Yeah.
But in January 1914, so he's been in there for just over 2 years, this Catholic priest, who doesn't have a name, I just know him as Catholic priest, engineered to have him moved to an insane asylum. It was a hospital for the cure of the insane.
But those are not good places.
No, because he reasoned that this woman, quote, woman, must be insane.
Oh, so... As in, he thinks he has invented, or he thinks, the Catholic priest thinks this is a woman who has invented this past that he's now telling everyone?
Yeah, or has lived a lie for so long. Or just
thinks that, like, all of it is true, but he
must
be a woman who is insane.
This causes a complete explosion in the papers. This actually went all the way over here.
Really?
The papers knew about it here. I was reading them the other day. It's incredible. Because the first people who come after him are the Pension Bureau. Because they're like, hang on.
You can't be a real soldier.
Well, were you? No. They're like, prove that you were that soldier.
Oh, we've been paying this person,
but that person was
a man.
Yeah. So,
wow.
And so, this is where we get all this incredible, is what's amazing.
I hate that it's like the money men. It's pensioners, it's insurance companies. It'll be an insurance company, won't it?
Yeah,
and they're
yeah.
like, we're not paying this.
But you wait. So who comes out the woodwork?
Lish.
All of Al's old G company who are in their 60s and 70s, right? And you think when they get older, you might expect them to be more conservative, more like...
Oh, but not a brother in arms.
But they all go into bat for him and say, this was him. All those stories I told you earlier, they came up at the pension tribunal.
And at that point, they will have read in the newspapers...
Yeah, they were absolutely flummoxed.
Albert was trans.
All of them. Well, wow. Yeah. As they said, Albert was a girl.
Yeah.
That's how they put it. But yes, Albert was trans. And they were like, we never cared. We never cared. Like, if we'd known, it wouldn't have mattered. Comrade first. He deserves his pension. So he got his pension, right? But he was now in this horrible place, right?
Mm.
And they started to come and visit him over the time at Quincy and then at the insane asylum, right?
Mm.
But what was terrible was at the insane asylum, he was forced to wear women's clothes.
Oh.
Like, literally tooth and nail, he fought against it, right? And he's in his 70s, he's in early 70s now.
Just...
And they're, like...
And I suppose if they think the trans identity is a mental issue, they assume they think they're fixing it by putting him back into women's clothes.
Or it's just punishment.
Yeah.
Just for being sinful.
I mean, I assume it will be, if it was moved by a Catholic priest, it will be a church run
probably
insane asylum.
Well, yeah. I know, I think
at least church connected.
Yeah. Well, and so Charles Ives, this bastion of a friend, probably his best friend in his whole life, Al, he goes and finds him in the asylum. And I've got a quote. So what he found was a frail woman of 70, broken. This is a quote. They told me she was as awkward as could be in them women's clothes. One day she tripped and fell and shattered her hip and she never recovered.
On presumably a dress and a skirt that
she'd been forced
to wear.
She'd never worn one.
No.
Oh, sorry, he had never worn one.
Yeah.
So, and that's what happened. So he then has a shattered hip. And is not being looked after. And just as he hears like, I think it was in the same year. Yeah, it was in the same year that he hears that he's getting his identity. Oh, I've got to read you this. So the Pension Bureau, right? This is what they said. Again, this is a quote. This is the case settled in Al's favor.
Oh, okay.
It settles in his favor. The pension, that he gets his pension because of all the testimony from his comrades.
Because they can't prove it's not him.
No, they exactly.
They're really trying.
Where it went, so this is the quote. The evidence secured in this case shows beyond any possible doubt that the pensioner is the person who rendered the service. Identity may be accepted.
Wow.
Close quote. So that was on the 10th of February, 1950.
Identity. Still, they're still saying maybe, but...
No, but in that it means it is.
Is, yeah.
Is
yeah.
accepted.
It may... Oh, I see. It may be.
Yeah.
Not maybe.
Right. No, yeah. So he has got his pension, and it's... Mm. But then, so that's on the 10th of February, he then has this fall, and he dies of an infection caused by that.
Oh.
And he dies on the 10th of October, 1915, at the age of 71 years old. Now, obviously, terrible end for Al. But now what do you do with the body?
Mm.
And
do you bury him as a soldier, as he deserves?
You'd hope, right? But we're talking... come on. What are the chances?
I mean, the people who are in control of that are the people who forced him to wear a dress.
Yeah.
And caused his death.
And then he would be for eternity in the wrong garb.
Yeah.
Underground, obviously. Whatever. You know what I mean?
Without military...
No military honours.
Well, it's interesting, yeah, because, like, they can't, like... I mean, if the insurance company has said, no, he is the soldier, and yet these doctors and priests are like, well, we can't not accept that he was that soldier, but we still don't bury him like a soldier.
So then the comrades come to his rescue again.
Go on, lads!
They petition...
Yes!
The army, the US military, to recognise this man...
Wow.
...for who he was.
Hmm.
And not only... do they get him a uniform, a blue uniform,
because
he served his country. God, yeah. I feel emotional telling the story.
I'm feeling patriotic.
I feel just so sad and like, oh, and also just love this allyship. Anyway, he gets buried in his full uniform with full military honours, and you can, on his gravestone, it does say, the original said just Albert Cashier, soldier, G Company. Now it says Albert Cashier, also known as Jenny Hodges.
Right.
But he is buried
in
full military honours with a flag draped over the coffin
and
a guard of honour made up of Yankee soldiers in the middle of World War One, because this is 1915. So he's buried there. And I just think, you know, that's the way...
That's where he deserved to go...
Yeah,
that's everything he deserved. And it's such a tragedy that the end of his life isn't as good as what his death ends up being in the way he's treated.
And I've just realised something else.
What?
So he fled Ireland for whatever reason.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a Catholic priest that fucked him up at the end.
God. Well, I mean,
maybe might have been an Irish Catholic
maybe
priest.
That's what he was trying to get away from.
Possibly.
It's a very high chance it was an Irish Catholic priest.
It was Illinois.
A lot of the Catholic priests will be Irish.
But also, Illinois is a very Irish part of the state.
You know, it could be Italian. There's a few other people they could be.
So that is the tale. I know it was a long one, but that was the tale.
That was a phenomenal story. Yeah. And you know what I liked about it? Because I think, you know, it's important that we tell more tales from trans history, because it's such an awful truth that trans people, they are fundamental to to human history. They've been around forever.
It's not something new.
It's not a new thing that loads of people say. Like there's loads of cultures around the world that had distinct different genders. It wasn't just two genders. It's just basically Christianity and a few other religions were like, no, it has to be two genders, and so that corrupted the rest of the world.
Yeah.
But what I liked about that story is that it's an amazing story of a trans person being courageous and putting themselves out there. But the bits at the end, it feels really hopeful that it's also a story about allies.
Yeah.
And it's about his comrade in arms and them finding out and not caring. So it's not just true that trans people are fundamental to our history, but allies are also fundamental to history. And throughout history, it's not like, because there's people who say like you couldn't possibly come out as trans back in the day because you would just been vilified, but there were people who are willing to do the right thing back then.
Yeah,
and I know that there's the whole thing about you shouldn't judge people from the past, and I do, you know, that does make sense, and I think it's a different time, but this is proof that there were people who were willing to put themselves out there and stand by a brother in arms despite what the news said, and not even denying it, but going, yeah, that's maybe who he was, but that's not who he was to me. I will stand by him.
Yeah, 100%. And also, he strikes me as someone who couldn't make friends easily.
No.
And throughout his life had to be secretive, so must have lived quite monkish life.
Yeah.
But when he did make connections, people who clearly liked him, because you had a family who built him a house.
Yeah.
You had a state senator who hid his secret. You had the entire G company batting for him in the thing. He was clearly likable.
Yeah.
And smart and brilliant.
Yeah.
And all he wanted was to not be known. He would absolutely hate that, well, not hate, but that we're telling this story now. Because all he wanted was his life to be private and get on with his life. And instead of which, he sort of like accidentally become someone who's very important to trans history.
It's kind of like a martyr, but not an intentional one, isn't it? Like,
no, it really
in a weird
is.
Way.
Yeah. So something I didn't say at the top of this episode, this is one of my pre-Cloak and Dagger days.
Mm.
I had another podcast which never got released called B-Listers of History, and Albert Cashier was my first story. And I've wanted to tell his story ever since, but I just couldn't find quite the way. And I'm so glad to have brought him into the Cloak and Dagger fold.
It's such an important tale.
Yeah.
And it's a remarkable story as well. I mean, and then also, like, even if we didn't know that he was born a woman or he was trans, it's still a remarkable story.
Yeah,
it's still an amazing story. That's what's brilliant about it, is that that does not define him at all. What defines him is being a brilliant soldier, being a good person, about being liked by his family and by the people who looked after him, and then the soldiers he bled and died with.
Yeah.
It's just, amazing.
Yeah.
Remarkable. And so, you know, such an important time to tell a tale like this.
Absolutely. So there you are, guys. That's our tale for today.
That's
thanks
a big
for
one,
sticking
but
with us.
Well worth it.
Yeah. And tune in next time for Patrick's next tale.
Yeah, that's going to be a difficult one to follow. Thanks, Will.
All right, guys. Thanks for listening.
See ya.